Call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. It is 2:05 p.m. on Monday, February 13th. Let the record reflect, the following members are present. Representative Dick, Representative Herron, Representative Gardner, Co-Chair Seaton, and myself, Co-Chair Feige. The purpose of our meeting today is, again, to hear House Joint Resolution 26, Sea Otter Management, introduced by Representative Peggy Wilson. We'll then have a presentation from the Department of Revenue titled A Five-Year Look Back, Oil Industry Capital Expenditures by Category. Arthur Martin, staff to Representative Wilson, will present. Mr. Wilson recommended, or Mr. Martin, welcome to the committee. And Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move CS for House Joint Resolution 26, version I, be adopted as a working document.
Hearing no objection, we will adopt version I as our working document. Mr. Martin, if you would proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to speak here again on this resolution. My name is Arthur Martin, and I'm an intern for Representative Peggy Wilson. And the representative would like to apologize for not being able to make it to this committee, as she does have another bill in committee at this exact time. So you have before you a CS version I. Representative Wilson worked with the Sea Alaska Heritage Foundation to craft the language in the new CS. During the initial hearing of House Joint Resolution 26 in this committee on Friday, February 3rd, a concern was raised with the ability of Native peoples to sell sea otter pelts to anyone. So we removed all mention of the sale of intact sea otter pelts and crafted the language in two changes that clarified the issue. So the first being on page 3, line 1, that now reads, Alaska Natives are limited to selling only authentic and traditional Native handicrafts. And then the second change replaced the third resolved clause of the original draft, starting on page 3, line 31. And it addressed the discussion that we had previously on this resolution that the Marine Mammal Protection Act restricted the allowable uses of sea otters to only authentic and traditional handicrafts. And as discussed previously in committee, the definition of authentic and traditional is too restrictive. The changes that we made would ask the Marine Mammal Protection Act clauses in question to be changed to read Alaska Native Articles of Handicraft. As you may be aware, Mr. Chairman, this issue has made quite a few headlines, even getting front page coverage in the Juneau Empire. And we are happy that it is getting elevated to this level and that we're having another public hearing on this issue that is critical to Southeast Alaska fisheries. If current policies of inaction continue, we believe that in just a few short years, humans will have little share of the dive fishery resources for commercial or subsistence harvesting. Areas that used to have an abundance of sea cucumbers, gooey duck clams, red sea urchins, and Dungeness crab are seeing the fishery depleted because of sea otter predation. And thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for hearing this resolution, and I hope that you're able to pass it out of committee today.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Horton. Let the record reflect, we've been joined by Representative Foster and Representative Kawasaki. Any questions from the committee? Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for being here again, Arthur. So now, the last statement that you made about just about the ecology and hoping that the management will include sort of an ecosystem balance. I guess I question the comment because it doesn't actually say the further be it resolved. That's in fact the plan. Really what it's saying, the way I understand the resolution to be, is that we're not taking a position on whether we should start to actively manage populations of sea otters, but instead that it looks like you're just urging the Secretary of the Interior federal agencies to come up with or to revisit this 1994 plan and the 2004 plan. So is that what we're trying to do, or are we trying to do something different?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kawasaki, yeah, you're absolutely right. That was an opinion taken from Representative Peggy Wilson, stating that the supporting documents that we have and the research that's been made on this issue has been showing that, you know, kind of the ecosystem is out of balance because of increased sea otter growth and population, and the resolution in itself is just asking that this that there is a discussion that's allowed to be had between the appropriate departments with the federal government and the state and Native peoples to discuss this issue. So it doesn't give, like, an active, like, opinion stating, hey, no, this is what's going on. It's just an opinion on the documents and the research that's been made.
I guess, Mr. Chairman.
Paula, Representative Kalsager.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The document that you provided last time from the McDowell Group, I actually don't have in my finder right now, but it mentioned a couple different sources, both sea cucumbers, the ones that you mentioned, and some sort of a shellfish. And it said pretty specifically, and I'll have to go to find that reference again, that it didn't seem that sea otters were the major part of the decline within those two specific economic populations. Can you address that?
Could you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kawasaki, could you rephrase the question one more time? I apologize, I wish I had another copy.
Sure. Before, so the McDowell study that was handed out at the last meeting, just reading over the McDowell study, the two species that specifically that were mentioned, one of them was a sea urchin, the other one was
sea cucumber.
I don't know what they are, but something. Basically, those two species, and when we're talking about the population driving down that particular population, it said pretty clearly in the McDowell study that that wasn't the case, that part of it had to do with just a decline in the overall economic viability. It wasn't because sea otters were, in fact, just taking too many sea urchins. That's the study right there.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, you're absolutely right. I do remember reading that clause. I don't exactly remember what that was a reference to, because the McDowell report does focus on three species. It focuses on the geoducks, the sea cucumbers, and the sea urchins. And I don't remember exactly what species it was talking about. And you are right. I do remember seeing that. But the study does show conclusive evidence that sea otters have had a direct and indirect impact on species such as the sea cucumber and the geoduck clams. And if you go to on page 30 of your McDowell report in appendix 2, it actually talks about the impact areas of sea otters on the dive fishery areas, and it specifically mentions the sea cucumbers and the geoducks.
You got an answer to your question there, Representative Kawasaki?
I have to look at the report. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'll reserve it for a while.
Martin, is that all you got for now?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll go ahead and we've got several folks that are present in the room that would like to testify, as well as several online. I guess we'll just go in the order in which you signed up here. Greg Brown.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. The resolution we're looking at was developed by a special interest group, and they hired a consultant to substantiate their beliefs.
Excuse me, sir, for the record, just if you would state your name and affiliation.
My name is Greg Brown. I'm testifying on behalf of myself. I live in North Tea Harbor. Okay. I'm primarily retired. I do a little business here and there, but primarily retired. Okay. Is that sufficient, sir?
That's fine. Yeah.
Thank you. The resolution you're looking at was developed by a special interest group, and they hired a consultant to substantiate their beliefs. In my prior life, when I actually worked for a living, I ran president and CEO of one of the 50th largest companies in all of Latin America, so I've dealt a lot with consultants all over the world. The way consultants group get to be big and successful is writing reports that people who are paying them want to hear, and that's just standard operating procedure. Even the title of this report is misleading. It should be The Effect of Sea Otters on a Few Specific Fisheries in Southeast Alaska. There are dozens of fisheries in Southeast Alaska not even mentioned in this report. Let's look at some other possibilities. sea otters could improve many of the other commercial fisheries. And I know there was some controversial testimony last week on keystone species, but I tend to talk a little bit about that later, but I believe that sea otters are keystone species. There's a pretty interesting report put out by the state of Oregon regarding ocean acidification, which is not covered. If we look at tourism, tourism viewing and wildlife viewing is a $30 billion industry in the United States and has grown over 6% annually, even during the economic downturn we have been experiencing. Wildlife viewing is over $30 million plus business in the city of Juneau. One whale, over the life of that whale, is worth $32 million to the city of Juneau. The reintroduction of wolves are worth $35 million annually in Yellowstone Park. A bear at Pack Creek to the city of Juneau is worth $132,000 annually. And sea otters could be worth as much as $5 million annually in increased tourism. And I know it's easy to say that, so I thought I'd give a couple of quick examples. Here's a report, and I can leave this, that was put together in 2005 for California, and one quick quote out of it. The eventual expansion of southern sea otter populations and range would provide more than $100 million of annual income economic benefit to California households. Now, you can always argue about reports and where they come from, so I thought we'd talk a little bit about some facts surrounding that kind of thing. Down in Monterey, 22 years ago, when the sea otters were being reintroduced there, they put forth the Sea Otter Classic, and it's getting ready to run again in April 19th and 20th of this year. And a little bit of information about that. This four-day action-packed cycle extravaganza features amateur and pro cycling event, as well as family activities of all ages, attracting more than 50,000 bicycle enthusiasts all around the world. The Sea Otter Classic also plays host for the largest consumer bike expo in the world. None of these were considered in the reports you've been looking at. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they've talked about the sea otters and the success and the economic impact favorably with wildlife viewing in Southern California. But since I fully realize that you can always argue any report and who pays for it and everything else, I tried to find the most neutral report I could find. So I went to McGill University. I lectured at McGill. I've lectured at Harvard and a couple other universities over the years. And I found a master's thesis, which was dated 2006, on this very subject for Victoria Island, just south of us here. And it was done by a young lady named Sarah Poirier, I believe it is, P-O-I-R-I-E-R. And it was her master's thesis, and so there should be nothing prejudiced about this. In this, she talks about the benefits of sea otters around Victoria Island and the increase of tourism and economic prosperity that can be gained by utilizing that opportunity. She also supports that the keystone species of sea otters is real, and she has, the report's 136 pages long, so I didn't bring it, but you can print it out easily enough. And she has extreme detail about why it is real and where it comes from. And so I think that's a pretty neutral report. And that was actually the only report I could find on the subject from McGill. And I couldn't find anything from Harvard when I looked. The point of this economic discussion and these other alternatives is if we would just embrace nature and not fight it, we can all become rich. The opportunity is there for this to happen. If you're making a decision based on the recommendations of a financial interest of financial special interest group, based on a very biased and woefully incomplete consulting report paid for by that special interest group, quite frankly, we're nuts for doing that. There's an old rule that says in business, when you get 80% of the information, add your own judgment and make a decision. You never can get 100% of the information. In this case, we have less than 20% of the information. So I would urge you to take the time to get the rest of the facts before you rush judgment. Thank you very much.
Questions for Mr. Brown? Representative Gardner.
Thank you. We had a little bit of testimony about keystone species last time, but can you just kind of reiterate what that means and how that plays out?
I will give you the best information I can. I am not a biologist, but I was actually with Dr. Mary Wilson a couple weeks ago about it, and I've also read this report that I mentioned, the 136-page report. And what they are saying is that otters control the number of sea urchins, and sea urchins directly related to the amount of kelp. When kelp is healthy, the other fisheries, such as salmon and other fisheries similar to that, are also healthy. And that's a short version. If you like a longer version, I can give it to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Mr. Brown? Thanks, sir.
Okay.
Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you. We have a chance to become rich with this topic, and I hope we embrace it. Thank you.
Next one up is Julian Curry from Petersburg Vessels Owners Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Julianne Curry. I represent the Petersburg Vessel Owners Association down here in Southeast Alaska. We have about 120 vessels and businesses that operate primarily in Southeast Alaska, but they also have permits throughout the state. I'd also like to mention that my members are active personal use, subsistence, and sport fishermen that are affected by the species that are affected by sea otters. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd just like to start by saying that nobody here is looking for widespread and unchecked harvest of sea otters. What people are looking for is balance, and I think that that's what's missing from a lot of the testimony that you guys have heard to date, is that we really don't have a good balance of what's happening with our resources in Southeast Alaska. So I got a chance to really quickly read through the latest version of the resolution, and I noticed that what is missing is the allowance of Alaska coastal natives to be able to sell and trade raw pelts to non-natives. And I'm afraid that without that language being included in this resolution, it'll be very difficult to support. That's a time-honored tradition. It's been happening since the dawn of time, and we feel that it's very important for Alaska coastal natives to be able to sell raw pelts. However, the rest of the resolution looks like we're heading in the right direction. I understand the frustration. I appreciate all of the work that's gone into this resolution. And if you guys have any questions, I will definitely be around. I noticed that in your packet of letters, you are missing the letter from the Petersburg Vessel Owners Association. However, the next time around, I'll be sure that you guys get that copy of the letter. But I draw your attention to the resolution from the city of Petersburg, which is where I'm from. And also, you have a letter in here from the Southeast Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, which the Subsistence RAC down here in Southeast has heard hours and hours of testimony regarding this issue. And I know that they'll be able to provide you with any information you need.
Thank you, Ms. Curry. Questions from the committee for Ms. Curry? Representative Herron, then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Curry, the comment that you had about the inability for Alaska Natives to sell to non-Natives, on that comment, are you suggesting that maybe there could be a reasonable quota where Alaska Natives could have a certain amount of otters that from the testimony they received before about that they should be able to use those pelts for whatever. Once that quota is reached, then it would go to non-natives? They could sell to non-natives?
Through the chair. Actually, I'm sorry if my testimony wasn't very clear, but what we'd be looking for is for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or for Congress through an amendment of the Marine Mammal Protection Act to interpret the definition of significantly altered differently. What we'd be looking for is for coastal natives who are allowed to harvest under current regulations to be able to sell a sea otter pelt to a non-native. That's what we would be looking for.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members of the House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We did get with the native groups and met with them. Now, has there been a change? Because we talked about how it should be worded and put it the way they wanted it. Now, has there been a change since then?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I know that a lot of the conversation so far on significantly altered and handicraft has been driven by the artisan market. So I know that that's helped a lot in the shaping of this current bill. That's at least my understanding. However, I know that there's a significant amount of just harvesters out there who would like to be able to sell raw pelts, and I know that they're not coming up and testifying, and I don't understand why. I mean, you guys know that sometimes it's like herding cats to get people to come up here and state their opinion, but there's a few more opinions out there than just that of the artisans. I think that the artisans have a very valid point. I understand the concern that comes from the sale of raw pelts as there's a small potential there for industrializing the current artisan market. Actually, I have some pictures on my cell phone over there. Sitting on my couch right now is a Arctic fox, just a raw pelt. And sitting right next to that Arctic fox is a sea otter pillow. I won it at a basketball game a couple weeks ago back in Petersburg, but what's missing from that picture is a raw sea otter pelt, which I would also like to be able to put on the opposite couch to really complete my look. So enough about what's going on in my house. but I know that the artisan market, that's one of the major concerns, is being able to industrialize what's happening with the current handicraft market. However, I'm not quite convinced that that should trump the overall good that would come from returning the right of the Alaska Native people to sell a raw pelt.
Mr. Chairman, as the resolution moves along, I will be glad to add anything that might help out with their concern if they will at least call my office and let me know about it.
Of course. Thank you, Representative Wilson.
Any other questions from the committee? You know, in the interior, I've got friends that collect bears and put them around their room. But it's a big state, right?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I promise the next time I come up to not talk about my decorative ideas.
Thank you, Ms. Curry. Tina Brown from the Alaska Wildlife Alliance.
Good afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'm Tina M. Brown. I live on Beardsley Way in Juneau. I'm testifying on behalf of the Alaska Wildlife Alliance. We're a nonprofit organization committed to the preservation and protection of Alaska's wildlife. We're the only Alaskan-based organization devoted solely to the protection of Alaska's wildlife. All of our board members are Alaskans, and I serve as the president of our organization. We have critical concerns about this resolution. It appears to us that this calls for the implementation of predator control on sea otters. We understand that this is a resolution, not a bill, but we stress that there are negative consequences of this resolution if adopted. They are tremendous. This is a foot in the door for those advocating for predator control on sea otters. It is intended to be that. In reference to Representative Kawasaki's question about that, the sponsor's statement seems very clear to me that it calls for predator control on sea otters. In fact, and my eyes are not as good as they used to be, and this print is small, the sponsor's statement says we can't wait for studies. We need to act now. It says good management calls for a new management plan now, not waiting for years more of study. And this is all on the internet. You can find that. Additionally, during his testimony before you last week, the executive director of the UFA actually stated that even though this resolution probably isn't enough to help his fishery, it is a step in the right direction. That's almost a direct quote. Last week, during a presentation, ADF&G area biologist Dan Teske was asked by a member of the audience when he stressed, the member of the audience stressed that predator control on sea otter population was necessary. The member of the audience stated that not just Native Alaskans should be allowed to participate, that this should be opened up to all Alaskans. This issue is escalating, and you haven't even passed the resolution yet. HJR 26 urges state and federal governments to work with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to reduce sea otter populations. ADF&G does not have a shining reputation for wildlife management. In fact, it has a glaring reputation. The department is shooting wolves from aircraft in the Kenai. It is snaring bears, including sows, and then shooting their cubs. It is gassing wolf pups in their dens. It is allowing non-resident hunting in some active predator control areas. I could go on, but I think you get the picture. Alaska's reputation for wildlife management is deeply tarnished right now. Can you imagine the negative press if we started what people would consider predator control on sea otters? Can you imagine the reactions of tourists and potential tourists? Can you imagine the reactions of Alaskans? Many have testified that sea otters are a keystone species. This is the truth. Without sea otters, you will not have the great kelp forest. You can look that up easily on the internet, too. They keep sea urchins in control. Scientists at a panel presentation during the recent Board of Fish meeting in Petersburg stated that research on sea otters in Southeast Alaska is underway and that more research is needed. In fact, the carrying capacity for sea otters in Southeast Alaska, and this was stated at that meeting, is not known, the carrying capacity before they were wiped out. At the same meeting, the Board of Fish stated that one species should not be placed in higher regard than another, and they specifically referred to sea cucumbers versus sea otters. Clearly, prudence is the wisest approach to this issue. Opening the door for predator control on sea otters also opens the door for predator control on other protected species, such as stellar sea lions and humpback whales. And if you don't think this is the case, you haven't been listening, because people are already talking about that. The consequences of this could be devastating. If the intent of this resolution is to provide greater economic benefits to Alaskans, native Alaskans, excuse me, via a more liberal use of sea otter pelts, then reword the resolution to say that. If the intent of this resolution, however, is to use native Alaskans as a tool to start predator control on sea otters, then the Alaska Wildlife Alliance strongly opposes this resolution. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you very much for your service to our state.
Questions from the committee, from Ms. Brown. Representative.
thank you, and I'm not sure if you're aware that we just adopted the I version of the bill, which does what you said and would expand the usage of natives to make their handicrafts, so that if they could use a zipper, for instance, in the handicraft. So since that is in there and there is no expansion of who can hunt or sales to other than other natives, does that not fit the criteria that you've laid out?
There are many whereases in that resolution, and some of that wording needs to be changed, not to address predator control. And I would be glad to go through it and mark some of that, but testimony previously, and you have some written testimony before you from other sources, clearly view this as a step towards predator control on sea otters.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Herron.
So I guess, just so I can understand, is predator control in any way is not necessary?
I didn't say that. What I said is that more studies need to be made. This is what scientists said at the Board of Fish meeting. I'm not a biologist. I know that sea otters are good for the marine environment. They're good for fisheries. I know that they're just making a comeback right now, and it seems wise to see what happens and not to jump into anything.
Follow up, please.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So, but again, I understand your comments on sea otters, but you made comments on wolves and bears. And so there's, so what you're saying, we don't have enough science on wolves and bears?
I'm saying that you can't always depend on Alaska Department of Fish and Game to make wise management decisions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Tina. Thank you. The Marine Mammal Protection Act is very restrictive in the use of these materials for Alaska Natives in the pursuit of their handicrafts. Do you perceive or do you see a threat that could happen on the national level with the reopening of that act or any changes that we're not seeing here? Because this is really directed at Alaska Natives and the use of those.
It is. However, again, I want the committee to be very precise and specific in the wording so that it doesn't appear that you are taking a step towards predator control on sea otters. I get nervous when I look at this sponsor statement, and I get nervous when I look at some of the wording in the resolution. We support the Native community, and as I said, if that's the sole purpose, then I think the language about sea otter populations increasing and being too much and that sort of thing doesn't have a place in this resolution. You know, if we want the economic benefit for the Native community, wonderful. But let's leave out the idea about how let's reduce sea otter populations with this.
Any follow-up, Representative Bennett? Okay. Any other questions from the committee?
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Brown.
Thank you.
This time in Sitka, we've got Mike Miller. From the IPCOMM.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is, for the record, Mike Miller. I'm from Sitka, but I'm the chairman of Indigenous Peoples Council for Marine Mammals. We're an 18-member organization, all the organized marine mammal hunting groups in the state of Alaska. We have a co-management umbrella agreement with National Marine Fisheries and U.S. Fish and Wildlife to deal with issues of common concern around the state on the mammals under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. So it's been interesting to listen to the all the different points. I agree with a lot of the points from both sides that are brought out. I guess to start with, I want to I believe I've submitted comments that I made to a Resources Committee hearing on Congressman Young's legislation back in October, and that should be, if you don't have it, it should be submitted to you shortly. Specific to the resolution that's before you today, I'm going to, you know, speak in support of it. I like the language. I understand the concerns about, you know, the concept of people thinking that we're getting into a predator control program, and definitely don't want to, you know, use the act for anything along those purposes. But I think the whole concept of, as it states in the opening lines, you know, establishing strategies and plans for sustainable management of the otter population is very consistent with everything we've worked for within the Native community. I appreciate the changes that have happened to the language and would support the version I, is what I understand it is, that's before you. I think there is, you know, we're looking at this as, you know, kind of two different approaches to it. There's definitely a concern in the Native community about the impact that the otters have. They want to conserve the species, but, you know, conservation is the wise use of a resource. It's not preservation. And we need to protect both, you know, the otters, but also the resources that the communities rely on, both in subsistence and commercial shellfish and things like that. I do believe the root of the problem is we could certainly make a lot of headway by dealing with some other more issues related to definitions. I don't think we necessarily need to open up the Marine Mammal Protection Act for that. The Native community obviously has concerns about definitions of significantly altered and things like that. I've done this issue for probably about 15 years. I facilitated the harvest management workshop for Fish and Wildlife Service. We've started the tannery here in Sitka to promote economic opportunities for our tribal members here. And so I certainly open to questions as to different ideas. We definitely have had a lot of concerns with some of the law enforcement actions that have happened and the confusion that is brought on our hunters and artisans because of that. I don't know how in depth the committee wants to get on this, but I just in closing will go ahead and speak again in support of the new language without any changes to it. And again, encourage any questions. So thank you for the time.
Questions from the committee for Mr. Miller.
Thank you. Mr. Miller, you may not be the best person to answer this question, but I suspect you can answer it. And that is, in terms of the use of sea otters currently, who determines who qualifies as native? And how would a native harvester know? I mean, obviously people are going to know most of the people in their community, but if somebody's native and goes to a larger community and sells a sea otter pelt, I mean, how does that person determine whether the buyer qualifies to own it?
Well, through the chair, so there is an exemption in the Marine Mammal Protection Act under, I believe it's Section 101B for Alaska Natives, coastal natives, to do that. Harvest and then make use of the otter for handicrafts, but also amongst other natives to be able to trade and sell pelts to other qualified natives. Further down in regulation, in definitions there, the way it's defined, and I believe it's enforced, and there's always some question as to how that is figured out by the different solicitors of the respective agencies, but they consider, for the purposes of the act, an Alaska native who lives on the coast of one quarter blood quantum or greater, and so that's how they say that they enforce that. Now, of course, there's a lot of people that are quarter blood or a bit more that it would be hard to determine if they were or not, unless they showed ID, and so that really raises some questions as to how you would really enforce that, and so there's a lot of that come back to questions about how things are enforced, and I think we need to get some clarity on those things before we can really fully utilize the species and have a big impact and help ourselves as well.
Thank you.
Any other questions to me, Representative Dick?
If I could respond to that, I'm the only non-native in my family, and all my family members have a BIA card that shows what fraction Native Alaskan they are. So that card isn't hard to get.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Miller, for your testimony. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, at this time, is there anybody else online? Anybody else in the room that would like to testify on this particular resolution? Okay, at this time, we'll close public testimony on House Joint Resolution 26, and I'll entertain a motion to move the resolution. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under discussion, before I make the motion, I would just like to reiterate that I think that the I version cleaned up the potential problems that were in the bill. I wouldn't be making a motion to move this bill if it allowed sale to non-natives. I think we would be expanding. First of all, I think we would be hurting the native artisan community and the authenticity of sales that we would get to tourists and others. And also, I think that we could be in a situation where you would have one shooter that was qualified and the rest of the people on the boat would be non-natives. And I think that we would have a hard time getting control of that situation. So I would just like to preface that I think that the sponsor has done a very good job in expanding the use within the Native community, but without getting into a situation where we could have less control on the harvest. So with that, Mr. Is there further discussion?
I just wanted to make one point.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. And I agree with Representative Seaton. I would suggest to the sponsor, though, that some of the language, some of the editorializing language, be maybe toned down just a little bit. I agree with the resolution. I think it's important. But, for instance, you know, unmanaged high numbers of reintroduced. I mean, if we just state the facts, I think sometimes it's more powerful than using editorial descriptive words and trying to kind of build up the hysteria a little bit around the issue, if you would. Thank you.
And our discussion, Representative Kawasaki.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with the previous two speakers. You know, the resolution, as I've read it several times now, it just, you know, it calls for the legislature to work with the Secretary of the Interior, Department of Fish and Game, come up with local plans, and I appreciate the sponsor's willingness to change the portion dealing with the with Alaska Native and traditional artifacts. You know, I would agree a lot with the previous speaker. I wish we could fix it at this time. I don't know if there's any fixes until we maybe see it soon. But, you know, I found the citations from this McDowell Group report. You know, and I'm not going to debate. The only thing I'll just say is that a lot of study has not been done, and a lot more study needs to be done in any management plan. You know, for sea cucumbers, 1992, Fish and Game has closed 7 areas. Either specifically or presumably due to sea otter predation. It's pretty inconclusive. And for geoduck clams, 4th bullet down, no geoduck harvests have ever been closed due to sea otter predation. But Fish and Game's identified some areas where there could be sea otter predation. Red sea urchins, sea otter predation impacts since 2005 have not been compiled. The decline of red sea urchin in recent years is related to market factors, not due to sea otter predation. Dungeness crab, it doesn't actually say any, it doesn't have any information on it really. And abalone, the fishery collapsed almost certainly because of excessive harvests in the 70s and 80s, and continues on. The decline of the abalone fishery, like the decline of the red sea urchin fishery, was not related to sea otter predation. You know, there's a lot of questions that I would like to ask the Department of Fish and Game on how they come up with those numbers. You know, I think we should have a thoughtful debate about this, and I appreciate the sponsor's willingness to continue on. Thank you.
Representative.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I understand the concern of the folks that are asking for more study, and I thought if we were going to head out with boats and guns tomorrow morning, we'd definitely be premature. But I also know that while we were talking about in the days of predator control with wolves, the cry, we need more study, it went on for 8 years, and it left us with absolutely no moose population whatsoever. So given the timing of this, I agree, we need more study. But given the timing of this, it's a high-profile issue, and I'm certainly we're going to have perhaps even more study than we need.
I think the big part of the resolution is simply get Fish and Wildlife Service to come up with a plan. That's all we can ask. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move CS for House Joint Resolution 26, version I from committee with individual recommendations. Don't believe there's a fiscal note.
No,
it's just.
Hearing no objections.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Staff was telling me there is a zero fiscal note to the bill. So
would you restate your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move CS for House Joint Resolution 26, version I, with individual recommendation and attached zero fiscal note.
Hearing no objections, we'll move the CS for House Joint Resolution version I with the attached fiscal note. Take a brief at ease while folks sign the document. Just so members are aware, obviously because of the extended floor session, we're going to run a little long here. I'd like to give Commissioner Butcher and his team an opportunity to present, and then we will plan on adjourning. So members, I'll certainly understand it if members have previous commitments that they need to go to, but for now. And we also seem to be having a computer problem on top of this, so members have the copy, should have a copy of the presentation in their packets, and that's what the commissioner will have the opportunity to brief off of. So without further ado, Commissioner Butcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, commissioner for the Department of Revenue. With me, I have Donna Keppers, who is one of the three audit masters for the department, who was kind of overseeing this five-year look-back presentation that we're going to be giving you. And this is the genesis of this came about in this committee, or, and certainly other committees, but probably first in this committee, when we discussed how much information the Department of Revenue in the state of Alaska had in terms of what we've seen from our tax credits, what our breakdown is of capital expenditures from the industry. So we began a process of working with the companies to try to get information for a five-year look back that breaks down by categories over the last 5 years what the capital expenditures have been. We were fairly limited on the number of categories we could do in a look back because companies do things differently. We started out with a large number of categories and it ended up getting smaller, and we'll give you insight into what we see in those categories, as well as an explanation that moving forward we are going to be working with the companies breaking down a lot larger number of categories. So all companies going forward will know the department expects a breakdown in certain categories of where their cap, not just their capital expenditures are, but in the future their operating expenditures as well. So not only will the department, but also obviously the legislature, the governor, the decision makers will have more information to take a look at moving forward.
I had a really quick question on that statement.
Real quick, because he's got to be at Center Resources at 3:30.
I've got to leave in 3.5 minutes.
Okay.
you mentioned that the types of categories audited are limited, that you started with a large number and then had to shrink it down because the companies do business differently. Why doesn't the state establish the categories and then have them say this is where the categories go? It seems like a reverse engineering type situation.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I agree with you on that, and that is what we're going to be doing moving forward. But the companies that have already filed 5 years worth of returns have different limits, and we met with a couple of dozen companies in total as we were working on this process, and they all have different ways of categorizing their expenditures. And the problem was in the looking back, trying to, number one, get categories that all the companies could get us data on, and number two, could do it in a rather quick fashion, because we wanted to gather this information in time to get presentations for this legislative session. We didn't want it to go on for years. So I agree with you that going forward, that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to work on specifically what we want, and companies are going to know moving into the future where they need to, what they need to categorize and how they need to categorize it to best make sense for the department.
Just a follow-up. Is the raw data available to legislators, or is it just to the department confined by confidentiality agreements?
You want to take that?
Yes. My name is Donna Keppers, audit master for the tax division. And in response to your question, if I could go back up a little bit more as far as the categories, we actually, Department of Revenue started with a very long list of capital expenditure categories. Several of us, two of us audit masters, have worked midstream and upstream oil and gas, so we're very familiar with what their cost coding breakdown structures are and the like. And so we started out with a very long list, and we met with the companies, and of course the look back short period of time, we came together, we met like four different times and came up with five major categories. We had to predefine what went into those five categories working with the companies, and that's what they compiled for this look-back exercise. Now, as we look forward, we had already predefined and have a very long proposed list, as a matter of fact, of looking forward not only for CapEx but as well as OpEx. We have walked down that road. We've met once with the companies to begin that exercise and that dialogue because we realize we're on a short time frame here in order to compile costs, in order to turn these things back around to you, so that you can make some sound decisions.
And if just a request for members, if they would just put your questions on hold till the end of the presentation so we can get through it here and with what time that we have. Commissioner, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll try to move through these as quickly as we can. Slide 3 gives you an explanation of the first exploration tax credits that we were talking about that was passed in 2003. The original bill provided for a reduction in royalty on certain oil produced from Cook Inlet in addition to the tax credit provisions, and the goals were to increase exploration and increase the state's knowledge of the natural resource base. As you can see from the bullet points, we pulled a few bullet points out of the sponsor statement at the time and some of the comments that went on about encouraging companies to drill more wells, looking for more information, and that drilling within an existing unit would not qualify, nor would wells under current development and exploration plans. Now, this bill passed when we were in the gross tax, not the net tax. So at the time, we did not have a tremendous amount of information on what the expenditures were, capital and operating, for companies operating. And this was kind of the first step into the tax credit side of things. Moving on to slide 4, it just continues to go through, and I'm just kind of skipping through this for time purposes so we can get to the information we've actually compiled. Once a well is successful, the state would stop recovering the cost because it's assumed that a producer would continue development at that point. And wildcat exploration in particular would qualify for a 40% credit. But the explorer must submit information about the state geology and resource base during the exploration activities to the Department of Natural Resources. Slide 5 talks about the purpose of the five-year look back to provide, as I mentioned, informative cost information to decision makers, to break down what capital expenditures were and how they relate to credits, to understand the benefits and impacts of the current statutes and regulations, to create a process and reporting mechanism to collect and compile this expenditure information in non-standard formats, to catch up on years of data collection that the department had not been collecting, but not in a format that we could detail to the legislature or to others on what was going on in more detail, and to establish historical basis for future analysis and comparisons. And a lot of that really kicked into high gear when we moved from a gross to a net tax, and we were gathering a lot more information on what the operating and capital expenditures of companies were. Slide 6, the process of information gathering. We had a lot of in-house discussion and review to come up with, as Donna mentioned, a list of potential categories that we would be looking at asking industry for information for. We conducted 4 workshops with the industry, and participation averaged 15 companies per workshop. Industry was responsive in both active participation and in their written comments. We established the capital cost expenditure categories and then developed both the five-year look back and a more expansive forward-looking reporting categories. Slide 7, the use of the cost expenditure categories, compiling a look back capital expenditures from 2006 to 2010. The reason 2011 is not included is their true up for their numbers for 2011 won't happen until March 31st of 2012, so we don't have that information yet in final form. Compiling a more detailed look forward as well as look back. A critical piece of this, as moving forward when we're asking for more detailed information in more categories, companies will be submitting this information with their annual production tax returns. And most of this information, if not all of it, is based on confidential information. The look back categories that we ended up looking back 2006 to 2010 were split into 5 categories, geological and geophysical, and that includes work or costs associated with the performance or acquisition of seismic and or geological and geophysical data. Exploration drilling, that includes drilling an exploration well, drilling an appraisal well that is post-discovery and prior to development, and including sidetracks on a discovery well, appraisal costs, including coring and testing discovery wells. Development drilling, which includes costs associated with well drilling, completions, planned multilaterals of development wells, including costs upstream. Also includes all costs related to well workovers and completions. Facilities, which includes well tie-in costs, increases to capacity, expansions of existing facilities such as increasing oil, gas, or water handling, debottlenecking or processing facilities, improvements to reliability or reduced operational costs, production control system upgrades, as well as costs for IT, communications equipment, non-production control systems, campsites or accommodation facilities, medical facilities, laboratories, warehouses, and maintenance buildings, and new or replacement transit lines, gathering lines, and flow lines, or the addition of new production lines and or pumps to transit or downstream lines, but does not include repairs to the lines. And the last category is kind of a catch-all of other capital, which includes significant capital equipment, health, safety, environment, and other non-drilling related costs that aren't captured in the previous four categories. The categorized capital expenditure data represents about 90% of the costs related to credit applications that the departments receive. And now, starting on page 9, we'll dig into the numbers a little bit, and I'll turn the presentation over to Ms. Keppers.
Okay, slide number 9. As you can see, we've got these are costs that relate to qualified capital expenditures, and as you can see, we've got two great big categories in there. You know, for 2006 to 2010, we've got facilities at $4.2 billion. The other $4.2 billion is sitting in development. That's the green bar. And then you've got G&G and other capital. You've got $1.1 billion. The orange is an exploration. And I kind of drew arrows, you know, on my picture. And when I looked at 2007, I could see, you know, where we've got development that's gone up a little bit, and then it took a downturn in 2009 and took another upturn in 10. Well, as you can see, the overall trend for all the categories, you know, there is increased spending. And the increases are likely maintaining production, as we could see there were no major increases or decreases in any one capacity. There were increases in development drilling and facilities in 2007 and 8, with a decline in 9. And 2009 would have been the first year that ACES would have possibly had some effect on budgets and activities. The increase in spending in both development wells and facilities in 10 was greater than in years prior to 9, and really provides no significant indication of ACES influences, but it may be a reflection of the credit program and more targeted spending for credits qualifying for spend. When you look at it from the big picture, you know, total companies, your development drilling spending could be viewed as generally demonstrated no dramatic increase during the four-year period from 7 to 10. So it was kind of like relatively flat. Facilities, on the other hand, that's the red bar. You've got that spending that mirrored development as well and could be interpreted as simply supporting existing production from existing fields. There was a slight fluctuation in total expenditures for these categories, and it could be attributable to annual cost increases, you know, cost of labor services, materials, you know, and not necessarily reflect an increase in overall development activity. I mean, it costs a lot. We've got the Arctic factor that just overlays everything. But when you look at the chart, you've got, for the period being reported, the five-year look back, we're looking at $9.3 billion of historical CapEx in those five major categories. As you flip to slide number 10, we tried to do a split. This one is for, we combined just the drilling and the G&G to kind of see what that activity looked like. And what we saw was, let's see, the development drilling, which is green, we saw a multifold increase. They're not reflected in development drilling. And we saw a twofold increase in 2007. So spending stayed fairly level for the remainder of the reporting period of 2008 to 10. And, you know, when we saw this, it agreed with statements made by some companies that they have had level spend to develop existing fields and are not pursuing new finds or development of new fields.
Excuse me, if I could just ask a quick question.
Yes.
This is for the entire state as a whole, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Not just the North Slope.
Not just North Slope. This is all companies, and as the commissioner said, we had like a 90% reporting of large companies and small companies. If we'll flip to slide 11, here's the split for facilities and other. We know that there were, as the commissioner went through the list of facilities, there's a lot of different costs that are lumped into facilities. That is a huge cost category. We recognize that. The industry also recognized that. They just couldn't break it down fast enough in the time that we had to do this. So we understand it's really broad, but that's going to get better in the look forward, where we'll be able to give you some more definitive, descriptive costs. What we saw in facilities, of course, it's the largest category of investment by all the companies, and we saw that there was some for new development and some for replacement of aging facility operations. What we did see, you know, as far as making this a better schedule to actually study, a better chart, in the look forward, we end up with five more levels of categories that we've proposed and that we're going to walk through the industry with. You know, in regard to, you know, there's three separate ones for facility categories, and one is facility support costs. We're going to talk about rate increasing facility costs and non-rate increasing facility costs. And then when in regard to the pipeline piece of that, we're going to talk about, you know, capital replacement costs and then, of course, your normal capital costs in relation to pipeline, because there's just a lot of detail that we think we need to see. On slide 12, we had a hard time trying to figure out how we could stay within the confines of confidentiality requirements in order, because we had to figure out a way to split these total costs into something that was usable. And we wanted to do cost by categories for independents and then cost by those categories for your majors. But what we found is that when we got down into the independents, that for I think 2008, 9, and 10, we couldn't meet the aggregation rule of three companies or more. I mean, those are, and so we couldn't break these schedules down by cost category. That's why they're big, tall, gray bars. What we saw was total CapEx for the five-year period for the independents came in at $2.6 billion for all 5 years. We saw CapEx increase in 2008 to 2010 by approximately 67%. So they're busy. Slide 13 is where we had to do the same thing, big tall gray bar for the majors. And they had an aggregate of $6.7 billion in total CapEx. And what you'll see there is the data indicated no major increases in overall spending totals, especially in the most recent 3 years of 2008 through 2010. What we saw, CapEx increased from 2008 to 2010, approximately 5%, very small. We know that these schedules, you know, going forward, you know, we have more players.
We know we'll have more cost categories looking forward. We know we'll have information for 2011 here shortly. So we'll be eager to, you know, for 2011, the cost categories will stay at the top five. But for the next reporting period, which is 2012, they'll be at a greater level of detail. And we wish that we could do this faster. But that's as fast as we can pedal.
And moving to slide 14, the conclusions that we've drawn on the rough information. We now have more actual information regarding oil and gas spending habits than we have before in the state of Alaska. Doesn't mean we're not striving to get more. We are, but just wanted to make the point that we have more than we've had before. Capital expenditures from 2007 to 2010 increased from approximately $2 billion a year to $2.4 billion. The explorers spent their money on mostly drilling of wells and G&G. Companies in the development stage spent money on development drilling and on facilities, largely. Companies in transition spent monies in multiple areas, depending on the stage in which they entered a project. And companies in the mature production phase spent money on maintenance and upgrade of facilities and development wells. We also have more players active in the field. This is not, as you can see, this is not telling us a lot that we didn't already know. It's just pretty much solidified for us with information what we already suspected based on all of the information we've been getting from the companies. I'd like to emphasize that the companies at first were a little bit skeptical of the process as we sat down, but they all did a very good job of sitting down. They understood what we were asking for. There wasn't any pushback of why do you need this, why do you need that. They've all worked very well with us, understanding the importance of the state of Alaska having a better breakdown and better knowledge of where the spending is moving forward. And then looking at slide 15, talking about our proposed annual cost supplemental information report. As I mentioned before, the report's due March 31st for calendar year 2011 by producers and explorers. That will be the last year of our capital expenditures look back. Moving forward for calendar year 12, that companies will know as they prepare and then do their true-ups in March 31st of 2013. We'll have more detailed categories following additional workshops with the industry, and that'll be the first year we really have a breakdown in much more detail based on the department dictating how it gets separated out, as opposed to trying to work with all these different companies and figure out over a five-year period how they could pull together their information as however they had compiled it into the past. We'll also be including an operating expenditures breakdown, not just capital expenditures, so we'll have a whole new picture of that moving forward, starting with calendar year 12.
On the look forward, we've gone from five categories to, you know, we've got a proposed list that at this point is four pages long, because we have to predefine what exactly goes in each one. And that's a pretty arduous task. And we look forward to our next workshop with the industry. We've had one already to talk about the operating expenditure list, and it's a pretty exhaustive list. But we're trying to basically merge the accounting systems that are unique to every company. And doing it the first time is hard. But it will get better. To me, this is an exciting time for Department of Revenue because we're able to actually compile something and look at it. So we thank you for your questions and that it made us look and made us dig and made us work with, because it's the right thing to do. We wish that it was sooner, but it's now. So we're going to make the best of it. And, you know, there's a foundation that we're laying here with the CapEx and the OpEx categories, because what happens is this is basically the foundational layer for historical data that will at some point import into the revenue management system. So, you know, the base layer that we're creating here for analysis is very important.
And so that's exciting because we can actually see where this is, where this can go and where this is going to go. And so it's happening now. And I think that it just opens up more information, better information, in more real time. More real time. And we think that's important to you all.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So when you kind of get done and this kind of gets in place, do you feel like we'll be able to say, okay, we want to accomplish this, and you'll be able to say, you know, in order to do that, if you just tweak this, that's one thing that will make a difference. Are we going to be able to get up to that point?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we'll certainly have more information to take a look and have discussions similar to that. A lot of the problems with determining, as an example, what tax credits, you know, if we were trying to assign tax credits to a particular result, is a lot of the tax credits we're paying out right now are going out to companies that are currently exploring, that are currently doing business. And we can probably say, well, okay, in 10 or 12 years, we'll be able to come back and point at this tax credit and say that either did something or didn't do something. But we'll have more information to have the discussion, but I don't know that it'll be as definitive as we'd probably like it to.
One follow-up. How long do you think it'll take? Now, you said you had four pages of categories. Now, are those, you have those figured out already so that they know exactly what they're expected to, what categories they're expected to fill out next time?
Yes, ma'am. We have a proposed list and they are all defined at this point. And it's a matter of meeting with the companies through a workshop to actually go through those and see if they, if we can merge those based on how we have defined those. Because as a state, it is our obligation to prescribe, it is our obligation to define, and it's our obligation to give the industry the guidelines that they need to follow. So in that partnership with them through the workshop process, that's worked quite effectively for us at the department. And so we will have our second workshop. I'm not sure when the next one is scheduled, but we have had one already, because the reason that it's a huge task, and it's very time-consuming, because you're talking with not only the accounting departments in the companies, you're also talking with the tax departments in companies. And in your larger companies, those are two totally separate divisions. And so it's a matter of bringing those people and that knowledge together with what we know and what we're trying to accomplish here. And then also keeping in mind the kinds of information that you need to see, because there's trends that you need to see, and you need to be able to come to us and ask us, you know, well, what did this cut and what would this analysis do, and what you need to be able to ask us based on the information you're looking at to do different kinds of analysis for you.
One last
quick one.
Okay. Now that you've got that in, or got that set up, that includes writing new regulations and getting the regulations in place, or is that done?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the Department of Revenue currently has the authority to prescribe and define.
Okay, so
we already have that authority to do that.
Yep.
Does anybody? I mean, how does that work? I mean, most departments have regulations get reviewed, and you have to have so many days, and you have questions, and do you go through that process? Yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, under our current regulations, we have the right to do this. It's just something that, with the department trying to catch up on regulations for PPT and then regulations for ACEs, they never had the time to ask these questions. So as we went through determining whether we needed that or not, the Department of Law determined that under our current regulations, these are reasonable for us to ask. If I could add just one more thing to what Donna had said, not just did we work with those couple different departments of companies, but also the IT departments. It's not so easy to come in, particularly for some of the smaller companies, and say, here's our list of 50 categories we want you to spit out, you know. And so that's why we've tried to work with companies to try to make it work for everybody instead of just throwing something out there that would potentially cost millions of dollars that could potentially be avoided if we did it just a little bit differently.
Okay, thank you.
Real quick.
Two questions. First of all, this was stimulated, I think, by Representative Wilson's bill to get information released. And are there any questions or any categories of information that we have the legal right to get that the companies have not been submitting? And you can get back to that us in writing on that, I guess. But the other question is on page 12 and 13, I'd like to know what the percentage of state credit is paid on those total. That was $2.6 billion, I believe you said, on page 12 for the independent companies and $6.7 billion for the majors. And so on the state credit plus the deductions, which would probably be calculated as a loss carry forward credit, what portion of that is paid by the state, that 2.6, and then the producers, that would be what percentage of the state credit plus the deductibility subtraction, that combined amount, as a percentage of that $6.7 billion.
Mr. Chairman, we'll get that for the committee.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. We're people have got to go places, and we're out of time. So,
Mr. Chair, if I could just ask a question for the record, and it can come back
okay,
later.
Quick.
And that has to do, I think, starting with page 10, but with all of these charts where you see a little dip or the growth curve changes, and you'd commented on page 10 that you thought it was attributable to ACES, but I'd like to know what you think is the role of the global financial crisis kind of through all of that as opposed to just our tax structure.
Absolutely, yeah.
And why do you think that, I guess? Thank you.
Okay, on Wednesday we will hear House Bill 280, Oil and Gas Tax Credit for Kotzebue and Selawik. And we have a second hearing on House Bill 229, Big Game Commercial Services Board. With that, the House Resources Committee will adjourn at 3:28 p.m.